From WBUR Boston, this is Here and Now, a daily digest of news and culture.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Verizon Wireless, working to constantly strengthen the connection quality and reliability of its network. Verizon Wireless, our people, our network.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation about design and architecture for the world's poor, building a better water jug or a better refugee camp. But first, boy genius exits right. That could sum up news from the White House today as Karl Rove, President Bush's longtime chief political strategist, announced that he would leave his White House post at the end of August to spend time with his wife and son. Boy genius and architect are the president's nicknames for Rove. Critics called him Bush's brain, and both critics and admirers give Karl Rove credit for President Bush's electoral victories from the governorship of Texas to two runs for the White House. Joining us is Anna Marie Cox, Washington editor for Time Magazine. And Anna, how is this being read in Washington?
Well, I think there's a lot of people trying to definitely read Rove's entrails right now. It's very hard to take him at his word. He's known for such a devious approach to politics.
Well, some would say
within wheels.
Some would say brilliant. We'd have to say his supporters would say brilliant.
Well, brilliant, devious, two sides of the same coin, really. Mm-hmm. I think he'd accept both.
Yeah.
And he has a very good relationship with reporters, although somewhat, I would say, suspicious of each other. And I think that everyone's just trying to read as much as they can into it, but he hasn't given us much to go on.
Well,
in a way, there's almost too many things surrounding it. There's all these different investigations. There's an unpopular president. There's, you know, Republicans looking at a very tough election in 2008. You could invent a whole list of reasons why he might be leaving. No one wants to believe it's as simple as spending more time with his family.
Well, Senator Patrick Leahy, head of the Senate Judiciary Committee, weighed in today. We should give some background first. You mentioned criticism of Karl Rove. He's under subpoena from the Senate Judiciary Committee for failing to testify in the firing of federal prosecutors. And separately, columnist Robert Novak said Karl Rove was his source and the outing of CIA agent Valerie Plame. Louis Libby's lawyers said Libby was a victim of a conspiracy to protect Rove in that case, although Rove was never charged. And today, Senator Leahy said, Mr. Rove acted as if he was above the law. That is wrong. Now that he's leaving the White House while under subpoena, I continue to ask what Mr. Rove and others at the White House are so desperate to hide.
I think that Leahy sort of sums up the worst suspicions of Washington on this level. There are a lot of people, I should say a lot of Republicans, who say that we should simply take Karl at his word. He's been a long, hard 7 years here, more than that if you count all the time he's been with the president. And that, you know, he said before that he doesn't want to be involved in 2008. He's made that very clear. And I think that there was a concern, if you believe the White House's word on this, there was a concern that if he stayed in the White House past Labor Day, there'd be inevitable that he'd be sort of caught up in 2008.
Well, didn't White House Chief of Staff Josh Bolton tell senior aides that if they stayed past Labor Day, they were obliged to stay on till the end of the term?
That's right. That's right. And it's well, and Josh Bolton also, there's some suspicion that Bolton is hoping to repair relationships between the White House and the Hill, and that Karl Rove has not been especially helpful in repairing those relationships. And so it's not as though Josh Bolton is really, you know, wringing his hands over Rove's departure at this point. And that Rove's departure might make it easier to reach out to the congressional delegation and really get some things done that they haven't been able to do, as you know.
Yeah. I'm wondering, too, it's interesting, Rove is leaving just at a moment when the conservative wing of the Republican Party is having, you know, some difficulty with the choices for candidates for president. Rove, of course, helped cement the political alliance with religious conservatives in helping George Bush gain office. Is there any thinking that he may be setting off to do the same for another candidate? He said he wants the Republicans to be the majority party in perpetuity, and we know he's born and raised in Utah. Mitt Romney, one of the leading candidates. Is there any thought he might be, you know, making a move there?
He'd probably have to do it in secret, because I think right now the Bush's approval ratings are so low, he's so poisonous to the Republican Party. I think that any candidate that took Rove on would truly be making a deal with the devil. I think that you'd have the benefits of his amazing political skills and his ability to calculate around corners, as they say. You'd have, on the negative side, you'd have someone who is so deeply identified with what has become one of the most unpopular presidencies, you know, of American history. And I think that'd be a hard calculation for any politician to make.
Well, in the meantime, he says that next up he's going to write a book, and so perhaps we'll find out more. Anna Marie Cox, Washington editor for Time Magazine, thanks so much for weighing in with us.
Thank you.
Well, as we come up on the 2-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina, many residents of the Gulf are saying they feel forgotten, in which case they join what's being called the other 90%, the vast majority of the forgotten world's poor. In a moment, an exhibit that focuses on the poor and efforts by designers and architects to build and create for them instead of the 10% of the world that they usually design for. But first, one of those designers, Sergio Palloroni, is co-founder and director of Basic Initiative and a prime mover with the Katrina Furniture Project, building furniture from salvaged wood. Sergio's now moved on to building entire houses. And we reached him on his cell phone while he worked on one and asked about his group's mission.
Well, I think the sense that it wasn't just destruction, but it was just a whole history of craft and materials and everything that were harvested from the Gulf to make these beautiful cities like New Orleans. And it was all ending up in dump sites. Our effort is just to really actually make that material, you know, useful again rather than ending up as solid waste.
Tell us about some of those materials. What are some of them?
Well, in the first year, we started out with cypress and longleaf pine, which are just two extraordinary woods. I mean, these are the woods that the Japanese worshipped, you know, in their furniture. And they were found in abundance here. And there was so much of it here that they even framed the buildings out of it. You know, we're seeing this extraordinary wood that's being thrown away. But not only wood, but like beautiful windows, triple-hung windows and wrought iron and cornices and pieces of wood that were carved in ways they were never going to carve again. And we thought, you know, this is terrible. You know, this has to continue to be the part of the heritage. This is what makes, you know, the Gulf Coast so unique. You know?
Right, right. And so you started by teaching people, and that's the other aspect. People work with you doing this, and they learn how to make. Here, I'm looking at a pew and a table. Simple things, but as we know in the aftermath of Katrina, a simple thing like a table is a godsend.
Well, you know, the thing is that people look at it and they recognize it because they've seen the wood of their area, and so they recognize their own. They say, "Oh yeah, this is cypress," they'll say, And they'll have stories to tell about it. So their identity, their history is tied with it. You know, somewhere in their family, they might have had its history, or they might have been in their church. Their pews might have been made out of it. You know, their pews they lost. Somebody, David Reynolds, one of the great gods of wood down here, says, you know, God doesn't make wood like this anymore. And it's right. You know, you're never going to find a tree like this. So what we try to do is help people develop furniture which is built on the dignity of their history. And it really is about re-engaging people with what is their environment.
Well, now you've moved from using the wood for the table or the pew. Are you trying to do a whole house out of this sort of recovered material?
Yeah, we are. So, you know, we're doing it. We're celebrating everything we find. You know, it's like everything from a captain's wheel from a ship that was recovered after the storm to screens from the markets, the old screens from the markets in New Orleans to green and white striped boards that came from a basketball court. These beautiful materials, and you know, sometimes the finishes are just stunning. It's a kind of thing it's a found object in a way. You know, in the end, the people are so excited. We've built two of them already, and the people have been having barbecues there every day because people can recognize when somebody's gone beyond and made something beautiful.
It sounds beautiful. It sounds, uplifting for the people to see something that's recognizable. But I'm wondering if it's practical.
That's a question.
Yeah.
And so the other test case we're doing is we're building a house, and we're actually right now trying to build the first LEED-rated house in the Gulf.
LEED-rated, L-E-E-D, meaning what?
It's a rating we use nationally to rate whether our building is having an environmental impact or not.
Green.
Whether it's green. And of course, at the very top, the buildings are doing everything for themselves. You know, they're often doing their own energy, recovering a lot of their own waste, covering, you know, even harvesting their own rainwater, all sorts of things like that. And what we're doing is we're trying to make a gold-rated house. And we're trying to do it with as much salvage material as possible.
What else would you do?
We're also doing things like creating roofs that cool themselves by having evaporative layers so that they don't overheat. We're doing things like emphasizing natural ventilation so they don't have to turn on their air conditioner. We're creating places outdoors, intermediate outdoor spaces like porches and nooks and things like that where people can live between inside and outside and take advantage of the kind of mild climate of the coast.
Yeah. It sounds wonderful, but, you know, I'm thinking that's one house, and we know, you know, how much extra time it's probably taking you to do that. What do you think about there's another movement in design, designing attractive
oh, containers, for instance, like you see in a container
right.
ship, instead of going the direction you're going in, go quickly, efficiently, with some design element, but get people in homes.
Oh, I totally agree. And I've spent close to a decade in disaster relief through the UN and different countries, and I've been there, and I think it's something that needs to continue. But I think what's happened is that in the last few years, efforts like the one we're taking have enriched the language that we're applying to emergency relief housing. So ideas that we're applying may not all make it to the disaster relief housing, but some of them will. And unless you test them, there's no chance that they will. And what's interesting about the house we're building right now is that a lot of people are coming around and saying, oh, okay, this is how we can get the house high enough so that the next flood that comes, it would not be affected. You need kind of pilot houses like this.
Right.
You know, this is like the pilot Prius, you know, Toyota mm-hmm. building the first Prius and seeing if it works.
You have worked in informal communities, what we used to call squatter villages
yeah.
in Mexico. You helped create a solar community kitchen in two traditional villages. Every refugee camp can't have a solar community kitchen, but
yeah.
what? But what can they take from that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because what we tend to do as designers is that we don't tend to serve certain communities. And I think design has the capacity to solve problems. And once they've solved them, then we consider them to be part of the public domain. So we might come and design a house that works environmentally in an area, you know, without much energy use, which would be a great importance to somebody who's very poor. And yet they would have never had the money to hire that kind of engineer and architect to come and spend 6 months solving their problem for their place. And so often, like, we'll build a solar kitchen in Mexico, and then three other schools built one exactly like it based on that one. And we gave them the plans, engineering documents. We even helped them finance it, you know, financing sources, et cetera. You know, there's so many different problems in the world where people have really not been able to afford good expert help.
What's the appeal to you of these communities that you're working in now that, like you said, there's just not a lot of money to be made from, you know, designing things for people who are so down on their luck?
Well, you know, I continue to believe that there's an optimist in the heart of every designer in the world. And so I think we don't just go in hoping to design the $10,000 table. I think we go in thinking that our profession matters. And I'm finding a tremendous appeal from students. I have a group here of students from Harvard and Yale and UT all over the country. And they're actually, they can't think of anything else they'd rather do than this. In the end, there's nothing like you finish a solar kitchen and the last day, you know, 50 mothers cook for 300 children and you have a big meal, and there's a satisfaction you carry with you the rest of your life. It's not just doctors that affect change, but designers affect change too. So,
Sergio, thanks for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you. It's fantastic.
That's designer Sergio Pelleroni working with the Katrina Furniture Project. He's teaching them how to build homes and furniture from salvaged wood and debris in New Orleans. Work that's featured in Design for the Other 90%. That's an exhibit at the Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum. As we go to a break, you can go to our website, here-now.org, where you'll find a slideshow of the designs on exhibit at the Cooper Hewitt. And we're going to talk to the show's curator about applying these design solutions to meet basic needs around the world. Building a better mousetrap or source of light, fire, water. That's after the break. Later in the show, what did Pope Benedict mean when he said the Catholic Church is the only true church of Jesus Christ? Under this new edict, who goes to heaven? After the break, here and now. We just heard from a designer working with recycled materials to build homes and furniture in the hurricane-battered Gulf. He's one of a growing field of designers looking beyond the desires of consumers with disposable incomes to the needs of the other 90%, the world's poor. Their work is on exhibit in a show called Design for the Other 90% at the Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum. You can look at some of the designs online at our website, here-now.org. And exhibition curator Cynthia Smith joins us from Carnegie Hall in New York City with more. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I am breezing through the catalog that comes from the exhibit, and some of these things are amazing. For instance, I'm on page 52. There's a little boy pulling a water drum. There's other pictures of women pulling the water drums. We're used to seeing pictures of refugees, for instance, lining up at wells with whatever plastic bottles they can bring to get water. But this drum does what?
This is the Q drum. It was designed by two brothers in South Africa. People who generally haul the water in remote areas have to go many kilometers. And what this does is it really frees them It takes less time. They can pursue income-generating activities.
And by getting it off their heads, they avoid injuries because those water bottles are heavy. I just want to quickly describe it because it's ingenious. It's shaped like a bolt, just like a, you know, any kind of 50-gallon drum, except that it's sealed at the top and bottom and has an opening in the middle like a donut. So the rope goes through it. They fill it, I guess, as it's upright, and then you just knock it on its side, put a rope through it, and it can roll.
It makes it much easier for them to carry it long distances.
Yeah. By the way, how much does the cue drum cost to make?
This one actually costs a little less than $30. It's included in the show to tell a very important tale. While it's a very smart design, at this point, it's the one that the end user can't afford.
Well, and let's explain that, because as you write, 2.8 billion people live on less than $2 a day. In fact, you tell us about an instructor at the MIT here in Boston who asks her students to try to do that. 1.1 billion people exist on less than a dollar a day. This is the poverty that you're talking about. And so a $30 several-gallon jug is still too expensive for them.
Absolutely. Some of the other objects in the show are more economically sustainable, and that's a really underwriting theme of the whole exhibition.
What are some of those?
We have the Life Straw, which is a portable water filtration unit. We also have a number of micro-irrigation tools, a water storage unit, a drip irrigation system, a number of different treadle pumps, because one of the easiest ways to help people out of poverty, the rural farmer who lives on less than an acre of land, by extending their growing season with micro-irrigation tools, they can increase their income within one growing season. So a lot of what you're seeing in this new area of design is adding this economically sustainable piece to it.
Well, I'm looking at a picture of the Moneymaker hip pump. And you mentioned the Life Straw. I'm looking at a picture of that as well, and two little boys using it, and they appear to be sort of leaning over there knee-deep in water with what looks like sort of a turkey baster. Tell us about the Life Straw. What does it do?
The Life Straw, it's a personal portable water filtration unit. So as you pull the water through like a straw, it cleans almost 99.99999% of all the bacteria. It makes it clean so you're able to drink.
Isn't that something? Because as you note, 6,000 people, mostly children, die every day from waterborne diseases like typhoid, cholera, and dysentery. Well, we want to touch on one last design area, products that have less impact on the planet and come from local solutions. You write about a Boston-based group that helped develop charcoal from waste in Haiti, where people can't build fires because of deforestation there. And you point out thousands of people die every year from smoke inhalation from kerosene lamps. Now, one alternative innovation is the light mat. Tell us about that.
Well, the Sierra portable light mat and lantern was designed also by somebody else in Boston, Sheila Kennedy and her group. And they worked with an anthropologist and went down to Mexico and worked with local women weavers in the mountains. And combining low-cost, high-intensity LED lamps, flexible solar panels, and switches that you would find in a dishwasher, so they're somewhat water-resistant. These were put together into this portable lantern. So the weavers and the people that live in this community can extend their daylight hours without being on the power grid. So the children who often go down the mountain to go to school, it's much safer for them to travel. So it's a really using local materials and low-cost emerging technologies. Sheila Kennedy and her group have really come up with a very innovative solution.
You write that there's been a change in thinking that it's not, instead of top-down, it's bottom-up. Instead of designers imposing ideas on people, the idea is to find out from people, you know, not only what they need, but if they have the local resources to help make it. How much is that factored into your show? Can you give us an example of that?
A lot of the new innovations are done in co-creation with the end user. I think Paul Pollack writes about how he went to India when he first started out and just met these remote farmers, these rural farmers, and asked them what did they need. And then they came up with, well, they needed to extend their growing season. How are you going to do this? Well, maybe a drip irrigation system. Okay, what's locally available? We have some very inexpensive tubing, a plastic bag, stuff that looks so simple when you see it in the show. You're like, why didn't we do this before? But it really takes this kind of new eye, treating the people that you're working with as a regular design client, asking them what they need, which is what you would traditionally do, and then actually coming up with something that they can afford.
You wonder, well, what's the motivation for some of these designers to do this? And I'm guessing the answer would be, if you can come up with something that can really drastically make someone's life better, that has to be so rewarding.
Well, each of the designers in the exhibition is very passionate about what they're doing. And they really want to make a difference. They want to improve people's lives. And some of them are so basic, they can save people's lives.
Cynthia Smith, curator of design for the Other 90%. It's at the Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum until September 23rd. And again, if you'd like to see some images, go to our website, here-now.org. Okay, still ahead, Pope Benedict lifts restrictions on the Latin Mass, but isn't the liturgy anti-Semitic? That's after the news, here and now. Pope Benedict unleashed turmoil within the Catholic Church and controversy outside the Church with two decisions this summer. First, the Pope lifted restrictions on the Tridentine Mass. That's the traditional Latin Mass that was held before the reforms of Vatican II made Mass in local languages the norm. Then, and perhaps to some more significantly, Pope Benedict issued a document asserting that there is only one true Church of Christ, the Catholic Church. Christopher Bellido is assistant professor of history at Kane University. His books include Renewing Christianity, A History of Church Reform from Day One to Vatican II, and 10 Ways the Church Has Changed. Professor, your interpretation of the new statement, it says that there is only one true Church of Christ, the Catholic Church. Protestant churches might qualify as Christian communities, but they're not the Church as Jesus imagined it. What's behind this statement?
In the year 2000, when Benedict XVI was Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, not to split his personality, he was head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, CDF, and he put out a document called Dominus Jesus, which essentially said the same thing that this last statement said a few weeks ago, that is, that there's kind of the Catholic Church is at the top and all other churches are behind it, and in fact they shouldn't even be called sister churches, because Christian churches, that is, because sister implies a level of equality. So the statement that he made a few weeks ago doesn't really push Dominus Jesus in any new direction, except that it is now issued in his persona as Benedict XVI.
It has the papal imprint, yes.
It kind of has an extra level of authority. Because when Dominus Jesus came out, there was a big question as to whether or not that statement was infallible. And most theologians said no, and a few months later, CDF put out a statement that said, yes, it does enjoy the charism of infallibility. Mm-hmm. No other statement has been made about this last statement a few weeks ago as to whether it is an infallible statement or not. The question is, if it made everybody so angry in 2000, why would you make everybody angry again in the same way 7 years later? Nobody seems to have an answer for that, except that this is Joseph Ratzinger being Joseph Ratzinger.
Well, we want to ask a little bit more about the statement, you know, before we analyze it a little bit more. First of all, did it contradict something in Vatican II?
Well, Vatican II made a very key change. For years and centuries, there was a statement in Latin that there is no salvation outside the Church. And the famous phrase is nulla salus extra ecclesiam. And everyone took the Church, ecclesiam, in that Latin phrase to mean the Catholic Church. And then at Vatican II, in a series of statements, the Church said that there are different ways of making it to heaven. The Catholic Church still maintains that it is the one true and best path,
but
that God is going to be up all night and let her or him figure out who's going to get into heaven. Therefore, a Buddhist could get into heaven, or a Lutheran could get into heaven.
So this new statement, if it says that Protestant churches and other faiths are not the true Church, is it also implying there is no salvation for people who are not in the Catholic Church?
No, it doesn't imply that. It's this nuance of saying that the Catholic Church is the best way to get in, and that the other churches are paths to get in, but they are kind of in a second or third or fourth tier, if you will.
Am I hearing this, that the Pope is now saying you have slightly less chance than you did under Vatican II?
Perhaps that's a way of looking
to get at into
it.
Heaven.
Yes.
Okay, let's move on to the Latin Mass. First of all, what did Vatican II say about the Latin Mass?
Okay, well, Vatican II actually didn't change the Mass. What Vatican II and the statements afterwards said was that we really should let it be up to the local bishops to decide whether the Mass should be in Latin or not. Well, everyone immediately said, of course, the Mass should be in the language of the people. And so very quickly, nearly every diocesan bishop around the world had petitioned the Vatican to let them say Mass in their own language and dialect, and the Vatican said, sure, go ahead.
And didn't they also, in doing that, omit parts of the Latin Mass that were seen as offensive by especially
right.
Jews?
Yeah, there's something that's called the Novus Ordo, or the New Order, that the Mass is in your language, B, that the altar is turned round so that the priest is facing you, and the third would be that the readings were kind of freshened up. More readings were selected from throughout the Bible, so the selection became larger, and the prayers were kind of updated to say, hey, you know, the church no longer teaches that every Jew at the time of Jesus and every Jew since then has the blood of Jesus' crucifixion on his or her hands. And so all of those references from, say, the Good Friday liturgy to the perfidious Jews or the faithless Jews, all of those were taken out.
Blindness, veil on their hearts, it prays for their conversion, things like
that. All of that
stuff
was taken out.
Well, now, does this mean that with the Pope's document that it can go back in?
What Benedict said just recently at the beginning of the summer was you don't have to ask permission from your bishop. If you want to celebrate not just the new Mass in Latin, but the old Tridentine Mass in Latin, you can just go ahead and do it, and you don't need permission from your local bishop. So that brings back not only the Latin, but these old prayers as well. So it's kind of two things that are going on. Now, one of the funny things that's going on is you have these kind of 35-year-old priests who don't know Latin, who are reading these things kind of phonetically. You know, Lord knows what they're saying or what they think that they're saying. And you also have this strange phenomenon, which is really pure nostalgia, of 30- and 35-year-olds who talk about the glories of the Latin Mass. Well, they never experienced that. The Latin Mass has really become the final battleground over Vatican II. Some people who really don't like the new Mass call the Latin Mass the real Mass.
You mentioned one of the big questions is, why? Why the Pope would do this now? And we were asking the same question. Obviously, there's controversy within the church over it, reactions from other churches, Protestant faiths, Jewish faiths that might feel that their faith is somewhat sidelined by these new statements. But
sure.
We're also reminded of the recent blow-up over the comments of the Pope about Islam and the Prophet Muhammad. Given that, why would he send a signal that at this time that the Catholic Church is the only church when it might be read by Muslims as sort of an attack on their faith?
We have to understand this pope in contradistinction to the prior pope. John Paul II was a big pope and a big papacy. He was a mystic. He was a man of the people. He was a populist. He was an actor. You know, he had a sense of theater. This is a very small, academic, fine-tuning papacy, which is not uncommon, right? If you have a big CEO in a company who's a visionary, he or she is usually followed by a manager for a few years. And I think what Cardinal Ratzinger thought when he was elected, and he said this early on, is I know that this is going to be a short papacy, so I have a short agenda. And my short agenda is to make sure people know this is what we are and this is what we aren't. And I don't think he's being mean-spirited here. I think he sees this as his job. Let me clarify that we believe X and we don't believe Y. We believe one and we don't believe two. And I think that's what's going on.
Christopher Bellido, you know, we said that this is causing controversy. Is it? I mean, where are you hearing Catholics talk about this?
More and more I hear Catholics looking toward the next papacy. When Benedict was elected, my only immediate reaction was, well, it makes the next election all that more interesting. I think that Catholics want to know not what the next 5 years will bring, but what the next 50 years will bring. And so this coming up of the 50th anniversary of Vatican II in the years 2012 to 2015 will be a very interesting moment for conversations about the future of the Church.
Christopher Bellido, Assistant Professor of History at Kane University. His most recent book is 10 Ways the Church Has Changed. Professor Bellido, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Okay, before we go today, author Eliza Minot, you're listening to Here and Now. It's a ritual that new college students face every fall. They troop into the campus bookstore where they spend hundreds of dollars on the textbooks required for their classes. Textbooks for math and science courses, for instance, can cost as much as $180 apiece. In the past, students have had very little choice about the matter because these campus bookstores also had a corner on the used book market. Well, that's changed. Joining us now is Osman Rashid, co-founder of Chegg.com. Business Week says this is the largest of several websites that provide a cheaper textbook alternative for college students. Osman, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, the name, let's clarify because it's telling. It's Chegg, C-H-E-G-G, and it means what?
It means stands for chicken or the egg. It's kind of the situation that college students are faced with, you know, earlier part of their lives with textbook prices so high that you need, which you can't afford, you know, so it's kind of based on the situation.
Which comes first, you know, getting a textbook to later make money, but you need money to buy the textbook?
Right.
Right. Well, let's take a look at how it all works. I'm online right now, and I see on your homepage you can enter the name of an author or select a university and a department and a course and try to find the reading list that way. But let's start there. How many schools do you actually list?
We have 2,500 four-year colleges listed on our website. So that's most of the, you know, four-year colleges out there in the U.S.
How do you do this? How do you, you know, how do you get the books and then distribute them?
Well, you see, the textbook industry can be optimized a lot from the way it currently works. And by working directly with wholesalers or distributors, we are able to get a cheaper price. And frankly, what we do is we don't take, you know, the profit that we would make, we pass most of it to the college student.
Wait, are you saying that the high cost of textbooks in schools is primarily that there's a markup?
There's absolutely a markup. When the textbook leaves the publisher, it's really at 50% of the cost of the list. From that point on, you know, the distribution channel and the bookstores and everyone, you know, keep on marking the books up to pay for their costs and, you know, their profits.
Okay, a couple questions. First of all, the used book, you know, the world is changing so much now. It would seem as if one of the costs of textbooks, and textbook writers will say this, that they have to constantly update with new technology and new history information. You know, aren't used books immediately obsolete?
Well, no, they're not immediately obsolete because a typical edition can go on for 3 years. Now, what's really beginning to happen is that the publishers are trying to come up with more newer editions much more faster because the publisher doesn't get to make any money once the book is, you know, bought. Right, so if the book is being resold as a used book, they are kind of left out of that whole profit-making loop. So they try to keep on coming up with new editions. In some cases, you know, many books like calculus or laws of physics, right, they remain the same. But what they do is they try to make politically correct language in the next version without really changing the chapters or the questions or anything. And, you know, they increase the price and they put it out there for the students to purchase.
So, you know, as much as you can tell us, how are you making your money?
We have put marketing programs together for companies who are looking to target college students. The one big value that we offer as part of Chegg is when a student comes to Chegg, they are coming in a transactional mindset. They're coming to buy and sell, which is different than a social network where they're looking to hook up with friends, you know, look at parties and things. So companies, when they place their ads or their promotions on our website, students are more likely to actually click on the ad or look at the product or even try out the service that they're offering.
You're obviously doing really well. You just got a couple $1 million in funding?
Yes.
From a venture capitalist?
Right.
But I'm wondering if you have your own chicken and egg to deal with. If you succeed in driving down, you know, forcing college campuses to lower their prices to compete with you, you may put yourself out of business.
The industry is so big. It's almost a $10 billion industry. And we are not concerned about driving ourselves out because it's such a huge market, there's enough room for everyone to stay in business. There's so much optimization that needs to take place that it will take years before, you know, the bookstores or the distribution mechanism is optimized. So we absolutely are not concerned about staying in business because we feel there's a massive market out there for us to help students out.
Osman Rashid is co-founder and CEO of Chegg.com. That's a free website that allows students to buy, resell, and rent textbooks without having to deal with college bookstores' markup prices. Osman, thanks very much for checking in with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Up next, author Eliza Minot of The Writing Minots. That's after a break, here and now. Author Eliza Minot is one branch of that talented Minot family. Sister Susan and brother George are also writers. Susan's novel Evening just went to film. Brother Sam is a painter. Well, here's how Eliza writes about a typical morning in the life of a stay-at-home New Jersey mom.
The fighting for the last this, the struggle for the last that, Stephen demanding to wear the one billabong shirt that smells like sour milk, twisted wet like a cruller in the dryer that never got turned on. Sarah refusing to wear long sleeves in the winter and short sleeves in the summer, the transitions of seasons apparently really tough for her. Finally, after the most likely peak hours of nonsensical meltdowns, there's the end of the day, the finish line. The lights dim down in the swept kitchen, the dishwasher chugging along heartily, Margaret and Brian sitting in front of the TV or lying flung onto the bed. Wherever they are, the rest of the house disappears like a set on a stage where the lights are turned off.
The Brambles, Eliza Minot's most recent novel, is now out in paperback. It's about motherhood, but it's also about three adult siblings struggling with the loss of their mother in a plane crash years ago and the impending loss of a remote father. Eliza's real mom died in a car accident nearly 30 years ago, and her Yankee dad was said to be distant. Incorporating their own family life into their literature is a trademark of the Minots. But in The Brambles, there are echoes of Eliza's life as a child, but we also feel we're hearing about the family she's now creating. That creation was foremost in her mind when we called at her home in Maplewood, New Jersey last year to talk about The Brambles. Eliza just had another child.
Literally, I'm 2 hours home from the hospital.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us. And, you know, I mentioned, you know, of course, people who read your books know that you and your sister Susan write about your family of origin. I want to ask you about this mom in your new novel, being that you're a new mom, but it's your fourth child. Margaret is immersed in her, as she says, abundance of children. Who is she, this woman who's, you know, she seems dazed but incredibly efficient? Is she you, or is this your way as well of fleshing out the mom that you lost?
You know, I've become her. You know, when I wrote this book, I had a two-year-old and then an infant and then finished it right before my third baby was born. And now here I am. I'm living in suburban Jersey like her.
With Fruit Loops on the floor.
I've got Fruit Loops on the floor, and I've got my Toyota Sienna. It's almost as if I had waited, I may have had better material. I'm not so sure.
Well, but, you know, when you said, I've become her, I wasn't sure if you meant her, the character, or her
or my mother. Yeah.
Well, it is interesting because in your first book, The Tiny One, you write of an 8-year-old losing her mom. You were about 8, right, when your mom...
I was 7.
And now you are the mom. I was just wondering if part of that is, you know, about trying to write what you couldn't live, you know, because she was gone so soon.
I think so. Since I was sort of on the verge of really being like the mother that I am now, I mean, mother to bigger kids, and doing it without a mother around, I sort of was preoccupied with how was it for my mother. Or, you know, I certainly wasn't thinking of her when I would write Margaret, you know, or thinking of myself. Mm-hmm. But I was sort of maybe projecting. I mean, I must have been, because here I am. It's like fiction has preceded real life.
You wrote yourself a primer.
That's right.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, you know, of my sister, a mother of 4, who might say, you know, reading about the Fruit Loops on the floor and the chubby child's foot that looks like a mini éclair, or watching children's lives roll out like a tossed ball of yarn. I love that. A mother who begins to wash her hair and then forgets it.
Right.
You know, my sister might say, this isn't writing, this is taking notes.
Right.
Did you take notes?
Yes. I mean, even with toddlers, any mother knows that you're kind of all consumed.
Right.
You know, I never left shampoo in my hair, but I could imagine doing it.
You also write with pretty perfect pitch about a dying parent, dementia, decline, a daughter trying to raise her kids while her father comes home to die. Well, and of course, your dad, Harvard-educated New England banker, said to be remote.
He gets a bad rap, I must say.
Huh?
He was remote for being a guy who had 7 kids, you know.
An alcoholic as well? I mean, we know this from the reporting.
Yeah, he drank. He sort of just drank of his generation.
Yeah. Do you write of this, you know, helping a parent die from experience?
No. I did see him die, but my stepmother took beautiful care of him for, you know, 6 months or longer.
Mm-hmm. She was the one who did it out in California.
Does a writer get to bring their father home to die when you do it in your novel, you know?
Yeah, in a way. Just to imagine, you know, what it would be like to have someone like him. And at the time, it wasn't in my house, because this is not what my house was like.
Right.
But just in a house with children, you know.
Yeah.
It would be much different if I, again, was really writing about him with kids all around him as he died. My God, that would be a... That would be quite something.
You know, it's funny, because you and your siblings have written so much about your own family, people know, or they think they know, as I did, about your family. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's strange. You know, you kind of, you give up a certain amount of information just by writing things and leaving it up to people to imagine what's true and what's not, you know. But the percentage that I feel like I, and even my siblings, actually write about our life is very small compared to what really is going on. Not like it's juicier and much more dramatic, but, you know, you write about whatever things your little mind hitches on, the overriding characteristic of someone like my mother or my father.
Right. Well, and yet, I just want to touch on something briefly. Your brother Sam told the New York Times in a recent article on All the Minots that he's a little annoyed by his siblings, you know, reflecting family in their literature. He says his story's been hijacked by his brothers and sisters. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, people with brothers and sisters who would not be able to write because they wouldn't, you know, they can't imagine what a brother or sister might think.
Completely. And that's something, you know, I've certainly never modeled a character on my brother Sam or really on anybody. I feel like the family character, if anything, I've modeled them on myself, you know, and then maybe in the tiny one, the neighbor was a lot like my dad or, you know.
Yeah.
A little bit this grandfather is, but if I was to really write about my father, he'd be very different than anything I've written down.
Well, you're all, you know, bound by these family stories, even if, you know, there's different interpretations of them. How would you characterize the bond between you and your siblings?
It's lovely. I mean, and it's sort of, it's really all I know in terms of, you know, a support system and kind of the love that I kind of get from them that sort of fuels my life, really. It's not like we all sit around campfires and sing songs, but we're very close and supportive of one another.
You just get to have your little sibling annoyances displayed in the New York Times.
Which is annoying in itself, but, you know, we got to publicize my book.
Eliza Minot, one last thought. Another character in your book, there's plot twists and turns, and we don't want to give them away. One of the characters is sense of place, and in this case, that place is suburbia. I mean, you find the beauty in the backyard that many people might find profoundly boring, you know?
Terrifying, you know?
what are you seeing there?
I don't know whether it's from living in New York City for 10 years and then coming out here, but New Jersey is it's incredibly lush and green and, you know, fertile hubbub of life, you know, with all these young families everywhere and little kids and flowering plants. Paradise in suburbia.
Eliza Minot, her novel is The Brambles. Lovely summer read. Eliza, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And again, congratulations on number 4.
Thank you so much. 4 and final.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.